Welcome back into the show. I'm Dara Kennedy. Today on And Another Thing, we look around the region and explore the meaning of Pride, who is celebrating, and how the businesses in our neighborhoods are promoting inclusivity for the month. And if you've ever stumbled over acronyms or you just weren't quite sure how to address someone, well, you are not alone. We set out to ask a professional who studies this for some guidance.
I've been interested in the relationship between language, gender, and sexuality, and how it varies across class.
More from Professor of Gender and Sexuality Studies and author Dr. William Leap coming up later in the show.
I'm Maya Schwader. Just in time for Pride, some good news for the gay community in Connecticut. If you are an LGBT parent there, you might have spent much of your kid's life in legal limbo over whether they're actually yours. Yesterday, Governor Ned Lamont signed an act meant to update the state's existing parentage laws. This ultimately could be a big boost for same-sex families. The Boston-based legal advocacy group GLAAD was deeply involved in the process. A quick note that GLAAD, G-L-A-D, stands for GLBTQ Legal Advocates and Defenders. They are not the same as GLAAD, which is a group that monitors media portrayals of LGBT people. We spoke with GLAAD, G-L-A-D, Senior Staff Attorney Polly Crozier, and we started by asking her what the new act actually does.
Well, the Connecticut Parentage Act is a comprehensive reset for parentage law in Connecticut. And what that means is parentage is the legal relationship between a parent and a child. And right now it's really based on biology and marriage. And what this law does is say, here are the many ways that children come into our lives. Here are the paths to parentage, and here are the standards for protecting children in each path. So it really is kind of a law that protects all children and makes sure that our modern families, you know, into which children come in so many different ways, that all of them are protected. So now every child who's born in the state is covered by this law. So it depends on how they were born. And it really has a disproportionate positive impact on LGBTQ families, right? Because for so many of those families, those children are born through assisted reproduction, and they're born through surrogacy, or they were born through conduct, right? By holding your child out as your own and by doing that act of really parenting and all that caretaking. So for LGBTQ families, the law hadn't kept up with those forms of parentage. And that would, this law really primarily makes sure that every child in Connecticut is protected, but it has a particular positive impact on those queer families who have kind of been left out.
So what was the process like before this then? What would a parent who was in a same-sex relationship have to go through in order to officially be recognized as the parent of their child?
Well, for, I mean, particularly unmarried non-biological parents in Connecticut were unprotected. If you were a non-biological parent of a child and you didn't adopt your child, which is for many people a very expensive process, a cumbersome process, people are offended doing it, it can be a process that not a lot of people do. For parents who don't do that adoption process for their child, they're unprotected. And there was no other path for protection in Connecticut. Whereas in other states, you could sign something called a voluntary acknowledgement of parentage, like a one-page form in the hospital that says, I am this child's parent. That wasn't available in Connecticut. And there were really no standards to protect those children. And this law totally changes that and makes sure that those children have those core protections.
What was the pushback like?
You know, there really wasn't pushback. That's really the wonderful thing. Particularly in Connecticut, the bipartisan support for this bill was tremendous. It passed 141-1 in the House, and it passed unanimously in the Senate because people really saw that the system was so incredibly outdated and it just didn't give equal protection to children and was honestly unconstitutional. I think, you know, some people, it is such a big system change that there's some resistance in terms of, it's a big change, right? We're going to have to implement a whole new law. We're going to have to change forms and whatnot. But I think that's a different kind. That's just kind of inertia and system inertia. But even that resistance kind of fell away when people realized that for children, to protect children and families, it's an incredibly important law. And we're going to do whatever it takes to implement it.
You and several other experts who have spoken to the media have mentioned that the previous law was unconstitutional. How so?
there's in many ways it's unconstitutional. It's really unconstitutional to say we're going to treat children of married couples differently than children of unmarried couples. So that's one aspect of it, right? There was a system that protected the assisted reproductive technology laws, for instance, protected and covered children born to married people, but not children born to unmarried people. And we want to make sure that all children are protected regardless of the marital status of their parents. And it also, protects people of different genders unequally, right? Because people who are born to unmarried male parents could still sign the form, but people born to unmarried female parents couldn't sign the forms. So, one of the things that came out of the case of Obergefell versus Hodges and Pavon versus Smith was this notion that for LGBTQ families, you have to treat them equally, right? And when those families are marital families, that marriage really means all the benefits of marriage, including the marital presumption. So also we want to make sure that LGBTQ married families are being treated equally as different sex married families. So there's really so many aspects of the law that really needed to be fixed and updated. Connecticut was the last state to really have no protections for non-biological, non-marital parents. Massachusetts still is the laggard in New England in terms of comprehensive parentage protections. And so we're really focused next on Massachusetts and making sure that Massachusetts passes this type of comprehensive protection for children. But Connecticut really was the last in New England to not have any protections for non-biological, non-marital families. And it's a particularly comprehensive and really well-written and well-done statute. And I think it really is an incredibly important signal to the whole country that first and foremost, we need to be putting kids first and making sure that their core relationships are protected. And that really is so incredibly important for their well-being, for their ability to thrive, receive benefits. And that when we put children at the center, we really have an enormous potential to act in a bipartisan way and really do what's right for our families.
Polly Crozier is a senior staff attorney with the Boston-based GLBTQ Legal Advocates and Defenders, or GLAAD. We'll hear more from her later in the show about what she remembers the day Massachusetts became the first state in the U.S. to legalize gay marriage.
Have you ever wondered why June is the chosen month for Pride? Well, on the night of June 28th, back in 1969, the Stonewall Riots, or the Stonewall Uprising, took place in New York's Greenwich Village, and a movement began. Dr. William Leap, professor of women, gender, and sexuality studies, and author of the book Language Before Stonewall, breaks down titles and terminology, and he joins us now. How did society come to land on LGBTQ as a descriptive and even category in such an ever-expanding space?
That's an interesting question as to whether it was society or whether it was the people themselves. What I can tell you is that at a particular point in time, and we'll use the period leading up to Stonewall as an example, there was interest in trying to find a way to talk about us inclusively and briefly. And so that's where you get gay rights. And certain people proposed the term gay rights. And that worked as an inclusive phrase because in the 40s and 50s, gay meant men and women. We got closer to Stonewall. Lesbian consciousness emerges and lesbian separatism emerges. And the idea that you can't just use one term for men and women emerged. And so you get lesbian and gay emerging. And that became what we used in the streets and on the posters. And bisexual voices begin to be added. Can't tell you exactly when, but certainly by the 80s, you saw the B. And trans voices, the T gets added in part because trans voices become not only more articulate, but begin to get recognized. And then with ACT UP and the AIDS pandemic, queer representation can't be ignored. So you get this kind of accumulation out of street action, out of political action, and then out of academic reflections that makes it difficult to say any one term can contain us. So not knowing the media side of it, I can just say that from the point of view of the academic and the street politics, that term grew out of a realization that no one size fits everybody. And that still continues, of course.
And you've studied this internationally. So on a global level, does there seem to be a difference between, say, the word gay or lesbian or homosexual in different cultures around the world?
Oh, good heavens, yes. There are, and I'll say this, it may be a generalization, but I'll say it, there are plenty of locations worldwide where you don't say it at all. Okay. People do what they do, they love who they love, but you don't openly name it unless you're in a real secure place of privilege. So the idea of being able to name gay or lesbian or use a local term is a real act of courage and carries considerable risk. So all these debates over fine-tuned terminology, no. That's a luxury yet to be imagined. Just the right to name lesbian and gay itself becomes a point of struggle. In some areas of Southern Africa where I've worked, gay doesn't have a meaning for you. And there's a question of what kind of label, if you're going to have a label, should you use? And that's a real issue when people are talking about gay rights. You say, no, you know, I like men, I'm not gay. We know that as a being in the closet, but there it doesn't mean you're in the closet. It means you're thinking politically in very different terms.
Is there going to be an expansion of LGBTQ as we know it, because the world is changing. People are self-identifying as different. They feel different ways, and they want to term it and claim it and declare themselves something else. Do you think that we will eventually either find a term that encompasses kind of everyone, or continue to add on to these acronyms?
I think both is going to happen. Both are going to happen. And probably more. I think you're quite right in your first point. As people struggle to make sense out of who they are and how they want to talk about who they are, we're going to see a lot more of people moving away from wanting to embrace a single term to describe identity. And that's going to produce an appearance of fracture. I don't think that's what it's going to mean. It's just going to mean that people realize that sexuality is not the only thing that dominates a person's life. And you want to figure out how all those pieces fit together. At the same time, we will continue to realize, as we know right now, as we look at some of the political events happening around us, that there has to be some kind of call to common ground. And we have to think of a way that we can bring different senses of political stance and identity and whatever together to mobilize around events or activities that may damage some and have the potential to damage others.
That was Dr. William Leap, editor of Language, Socialization, and Silence in Gay Adolescents, professor of anthropology at American University, and author of The Language Before Stonewall. You're listening to And Another Thing.
New England Public Media, PBS, NPR, Local Perspective.
This is Marketplace.
Hi, I'm Rick Steves. Thanks for joining us
on American Experience.
Billy Graham is like the Protestant Pope.
I'm Carrie Healy, and this is Beacon Hill in 5.
And Another Thing on New England Public Media starts right now.
It's all on NEPM.
enjoy language and the etymology of words? I'm Emily Brewster. Join me and my Merriam-Webster colleagues, Peter Sokolowski, Ammon Shea, and Neil Servin, as we explore the history of the English language from the dictionary's perspective on Word Matters, a new podcast from Merriam-Webster and New England Public Media, available at nepm.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
The semiconductor chip shortage has been impacting the car industry, but the lack of raw materials is bad news for nearly every industry. Next time on Marketplace, we take a look at the global impact of the shortage. That's ahead at 6:30 on NEPM and on your smart speaker. And another thing on NEPM is funded by you and Barron & Jacobs, design, build, remodelers, turning the homes clients have into the homes clients want, adding space, comfort, and function, Old South Street, Northampton, and barronandjacobs.com. And by Amherst Laser and Skin Care Center, offering MiraDry, a non-invasive treatment targeting underarm sweat and odor glands, amherstlaser.com. Cloudy tonight, showers and thunderstorms possible with lows in the mid-50s. Showers likely Thursday with thunderstorms possible with highs near 70. You're listening to New England Public Media.
You're listening to And Another Thing. Pride Month is a global event rooted in celebrating the freedom from orientations. If you were on Google at all today and typed in the word pride, then rainbow confetti and country's flags covered your screen. Closer to home here, hotels in New England are celebrating by offering promotions for the month if you book using Pride specials. Jackie Kosiba, Director of Marketing and Sales for Connecticut's upscale West Hartford Hotel, the Delamar, tells us why they are reaching out to the Pride community and partnering with a nonprofit group.
We're trying to support the local community through Colors. They're based in Hartford. We are located in West Hartford, so 10 minutes away from them. And they ensure LGBTQ youth of all backgrounds are safe and valued and able to be their authentic selves. So we support, you know, and believe in this charity and thought it would be a good fit for our hotel.
The Delamar Hotel originally launched the promotion last spring, but for obvious COVID reasons, it didn't work out, so they're offering it again this year. Kosiba also said part of the reason the hotel has this deal during Pride Month was to make sure they send a message that they are an open, diverse place.
We just hope that everyone walks through our door feels welcomed and included, and the message is more or less welcoming.
Recognized as one of the best day spas in Connecticut and with award-winning restaurants, the Delamar was not immune to COVID setbacks. Now they have adjusted their safety protocols. They require advanced planning. And Kosiba tells us that she hopes this promotion opens more eyes to not just the hotel, but the West Hartford area.
We hope it brings our guests into the hotel and also experience all of the local restaurants and businesses and destinations that the local Hartford area has to offer.
That was Jackie Kosiba. She's the Regional Director of Marketing and Sales at the Delamar Hotel in West Hartford, Connecticut. If you're celebrating Pride Month and you'd like to learn more about their promotion, you can visit their website at delamar.com. That's D-E-L-A-M-A-R.com. Let's go back now, 17 years, to 2004. If you were there and remember the culture at the time, legal gay marriage seemed unlikely at best, until a lawsuit called Goodridge versus Department of Public Health came before the Massachusetts Supreme Court. Lawyers for the pro-LGBT legal advocacy group GLAAD argued that it was unconstitutional to discriminate against same-sex couples, and the Chief Justice at the time agreed. Massachusetts became the first state in the nation to legalize gay marriage. We continue our conversation now with Polly Crozier, a senior staff attorney at GLAAD. We asked her what she remembered from that day.
20 years ago this spring, the case was filed. So it was filed in April of 2001. And the decision came out in November of 2003. And I remember it. I was living in New York City and I drove to Massachusetts. The opinion was so powerful and so positive and such a kind of clarion call for equality for LGBTQ people that I think it really hit the core of so many folks, right? That to say that we're equal, we're respected, that our relationships and our lives matter just as much as everybody else's. And Anyway, that day that the opinion came out, I drove to Massachusetts and went to the giant community celebration in the Old South Meeting House on Washington Street in Boston. And the energy in the room was electric. There were so many people. The house was packed. And, you know, it was just such a celebration. And I think to be the first court case in the country that so clearly stood for marriage equality, I thought it was an incredibly special moment. And then to see all the families, you know, rushing to get married. And I myself got married in June 2004, and the celebrant spoke from the opinion. And I think it really was an incredibly positive moment.
As you mentioned, Massachusetts was the first in the U.S., and then it took 11 more years to 2015 for this to become federal law. What do you think it is about Massachusetts that made it the first?
We had a court, you know, at that time was led by Chief Justice Margaret Marshall, who I think really looked at this case in the Constitution and really, you know, was a phenomenal Chief Justice for this issue in that moment. I do think that Massachusetts had done a number of kind of incremental steps along the way to set the stage for equality, right? I mean, and some of the work that GLAD has been focused on since its founding is that kind of core family law work, right? That same-sex couples can adopt their children in 1993, right? We've had sexual orientation, non-discrimination protections, and that we had kind of built up the notion that LGBTQ people are equal and deserving of justice and liberation. So I think we had set the stage. And of course, that work goes on, right? And there's so much more that remains to be done.
Speaking of, we now have a Supreme Court in 2021 that's poised to hear several different cases about workplace discrimination, families and fostering. It runs the gamut, and many of these decisions could affect the LGBT plus community. What's coming next? What's next on the GLAD agenda?
Well, I would say there's a lot on the GLAD agenda, both federally and in New England. And personally for me, I mean, I do a lot of work on youth and family issues. And I think one of the things I want to call out is, particularly in light of the Fulton case, where the focus is, we really had a lot of focus nationally on discrimination against adults in the foster care system, right? LGBTQ adults and their ability to adopt children. But I think we also should be focusing on LGBTQ youth who are child welfare involved. And I do a lot of work with child welfare systems, and particularly in Massachusetts, I think that's an issue that needs a tremendous amount of work, right? That LGBTQ youth of color are overrepresented in child welfare systems nationwide. And in Massachusetts, we've fallen behind in terms of protecting them and, you know, a comprehensive policy of affirmation, access to gender affirming care, training for foster parents, access to affirming placements in homes. There's so much we need to be doing to make sure that youth who are child welfare involved are safe and protected. And I know that I think it's a racial justice issue. It's an LGBTQ justice issue. That's a focus of my work going forward. And I think youth issues in general, right? Obviously, we're seeing tremendous attacks on LGBT, on transgender youth in sports and in terms of healthcare, implementing anti-bullying laws, access to LGBTQ inclusive health education. There's a tremendous amount of youth issues we all need to, you know, keep working towards.
Polly Crozier is a senior staff attorney with GLAD, GLBTQ Legal Advocates and Defenders.
Thanks to our guests and for you for joining us on And Another Thing today. We welcome your comments. Call us at 800-639-9120. Follow us on social media at Hello and Another, or email us at andanotherthing@npm.org.
On tomorrow's show, National Cancer Survivors Day is this weekend. Could the new mRNA technology in the COVID vaccines also hold a key to curing cancer? Be sure to tune in. I'm Maya Schwader.
And I'm Dara Kennedy. Thank you for listening. Have a great evening.